All right, welcome to the Cavas Ships Podcast, where we try and cut through the fog and the murk, shine a bit of light on naval and maritime issues of the day. I'm Chris Cavas.
And I'm Chris Cervella.
The Cavas Ships Podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is one of the largest artificial intelligence and machine learning federal contractors to the U.S. government. HII delivering the advantage.
Coming up, the temporary closure of the Port of Baltimore has shippers scrambling to fill the gaps. Derek Miller of the American Association of Port Authorities will be here to focus on that aspect of the disaster that brought down the Francis Scott Key Bridge. And Xavier Vavasor of Naval News joins us for some of the latest naval products being hawked to Mideast buyers, including submarines for Saudi Arabia. But first, a look at naval news this week.
Houthi forces in Yemen continue to launch attacks against merchant shipping and allied warships in the Red Sea region and in the Gulf of Aden. The attacks, as they have since November, were from anti-ship ballistic missiles and unmanned aerial and surface systems. U.S. Central Command forces also conducted several strikes against underground Houthi storage facilities in Yemen. Early on March 23rd, five anti-ship missiles were launched against a Chinese-owned tanker, Wang Pu, operating in the Red Sea. While the first four apparently missed, the fifth missile reportedly damaged the Wang Pu, which issued a distress call but then signaled it did not require assistance after putting out a fire which burned for about 30 minutes. The Wang Pu reported it sustained no casualties and continued on course. The attack came even as the Houthis declared they would not target Chinese or Russian shipping in the area. There were no other reported hits or damage sustained during the week by other ships.
The U.S. Missile Defense Agency and U.S. Navy carried out an intercept March 28th of an advanced medium-range ballistic missile test target using an SM-6 missile. The complex test, held on the Pacific Missile Test Range near Hawaii, involved the destroyer Jack H. Lucas, first ship fitted with the SPY-6 radar, which is in the midst of an initial operational test and evaluation, or IOT&E. Destroyer Preble launched the SM-6 Dual 2 missile that successfully intercepted the target, which was launched from Kauai, Hawaii. Australia also took part, making what USMDA said was the most robust participation in an Aegis test to date by Australia. The Australian frigate Stuart, as well as an Australian E-7 Wedgetail aircraft, tracked the missiles and provided targeting data.
Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force personnel have begun training with the U.S. Navy to operate Tomahawk cruise missiles, the Japanese Defense Ministry said on March 28th. The Japanese hope to complete the training ahead of their initial acquisition of Tomahawk missiles beginning in 2025. In January, Japan announced an agreement with the U.S. to purchase 400 Block 4 and Block 5 Tomahawks. The delivery already has been moved up to 2025 from 2026 because of what Japan called the severe security environment.
India and the United States held their largest ever joint amphibious exercise in mid-March in the Bay of Bengal. Dubbed Exercise Tiger Triumph, the exercise included the amphibious dock ship USS Somerset with Marines from the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit, destroyer USS Halsey, along with a U.S. Navy P-8A Poseidon aircraft, and a U.S. Air Force aircraft, including a B-52H bomber. Somerset operated with the amphibious ship Jalashwa, the former USS Trenton, and two other Indian Navy amphibious ships.
In new ship news, Brazil launched the submarine Tonelero at its specialized Itaqui submarine building yard on March 28th. Tonelero is the Brazilian Navy's third Scorpen-class attack submarine and the second to be built in Brazil under a cooperative agreement with France's Naval Group. Underscoring the significance of the program, the launch was attended both by Brazil's President Lula and France's Emmanuel Macron. And the U.S. Coast Guard on March 28th commissioned the fast-response cutter USCGC Melvin Bell, WPC 1155, at a rainy New London, Connecticut. The Boston, Massachusetts-based cutter honors Master Chief Petty Officer Melvin Kealoha Bell, a native Hawaiian who saw service as a radio operator and codebreaker during World War II. And that's a look at just some of this week's Naval News.
As we mentioned at the top of the show, we are joined this week by Derek Miller of the American Association of Port Authorities. Derek is the Government Relations Director. Derek, thank you for joining us this week on the Cava Ships podcast. If you're like Chris and I, you've been following the news and the pictures out of Baltimore. And now a couple days in, maybe your mind is starting to switch from what happened there with that ship and get to what is the repercussion of this? What does this mean for Baltimore? What does this mean for the rest of the seaports on the East Coast and around the world, really? Derek, thank you for joining us. First of all, what are you guys hearing? What are you tracking? And what should our audience know about the repercussions of the Dolly accident and the fact that the Port of Baltimore is out of commission for weeks, months, who knows how long?
Yeah, and thanks for having me. Chris, the way you framed it, you know, the way we're thinking about it, switching from wow, that happened to what's next, is exactly how a lot of the government agencies and the port itself have been thinking about this over the past week. They went from response and recovery. Now we're switching to salvage. The port hired a well-known salvage company who's done some work on the East Coast. It's on its way down there. And I think people are still trying to calculate exactly, you know, how long things will take to get back up and running. I can tell you, someone did a calculation that the state of Maryland loses about $15 million in economic activity per day that the port is shut down, and about $1.5 million in lost state and local taxes. So certainly a priority for the region. We've been in touch with port staff there, as well as ports up and down the East Coast to kind of game out what's going to happen next. And while I think it's still kind of undetermined how long it will take to get the port itself back up and running, one of the great things about this country is that we have a number of ports, and that cargo is fungible. It tends to find a place to go. So whether that's New York, New Jersey, Savannah, Virginia, Charleston, cargo into and out of the United States is not going to stop flowing. We have a good redundant system for that, which is helpful. You know, this won't cause a supply chain crisis on the East Coast, which is good news.
Vendors were pretty quick. Vendors and port leadership were pretty quick to deliver that message. I mean, almost immediately after the initial, you know, thoughts and prayers messages were delivered, it very quickly, Port of Virginia out of Norfolk started talking about what it could take. You heard from Carnival Cruise Lines that they were moving their operations down the Port of Virginia. I was in Baltimore this week for a baseball game of all things, but was reading in the paper that the Port of Philadelphia and the Port of New York were also emphasizing that they could take more. What does that mean for them? I mean, I understand, and it's reassuring to hear that you know, folks can pick up the slack, but what is the practical application of them picking up the slack?
Yeah, so a couple of considerations. The good news is we're far from the kind of peak congestion that we saw during 2020 and 2021. So there is capacity at those ports. What they might need, though, you know, additional staffing, additional shifts. We won't see, you know, ships backed up off the coast like we did then, but it will require more staff, more time at the port. And another big consideration is, you know, that some of the stuff heading into Baltimore, heading out of Baltimore, is now going to have to be trucked further or put on rail lines for longer. So that's, you know, maybe fewer trips that those truck drivers can take, as they have to make longer trips. So there's a lot of consideration about, you know, which is the best port to best alternative port to send some of that cargo through, and what's the additional delay both in the transit time of the ship and then bringing that cargo to its destination. You know, one thing we've been talking a lot about this week is it's a shame that it takes a crisis for people to realize how important ports are. We saw that in 2020 and 2021. That's kind of tapered off. We got a massive infusion in infrastructure dollars through the bipartisan infrastructure law a few years ago, whose goal, you know, the goal of that bill was really to help ports prepare for the next crisis, to both grow so they could handle more cargo volumes and to prepare for the next crisis. And one of the things we've seen in the last year is actually that funding for key infrastructure programs has gone down. And so, you know, I hate to say it again, but hopefully that through a crisis, we might remind people that we need to maintain consistent infrastructure so that these backup ports or, you know, other ports in the region can have the capacity to absorb additional cargo.
I think it's a great point to make. You know, I mean, it takes a crisis to really raise awareness, but the, you know, different ports in different parts of the country have different levels of awareness. There are, I mean, you know, the Port of Baltimore, if you're around Baltimore, there's a lot of water. Baltimore is built, the whole region is built around the water. And wherever you are, anywhere in that area, you can see working port. There are, you know, there are different terminals all over the place. It's not obscure. There are some places, Houston always amazed me, that Houston's one of the biggest ports in the country, but it's all on a shipping channel. And nobody sees it. They drive over it on an overpass, and there's just a bunch of industrial stuff down there. And the aware, you know, the public awareness that this is a great big huge port in Houston is pretty low. So it's actually astoundingly low. Baltimore, that's not the case. But on a wider basis around the country and in Congress, you know, support for all this, this can't hurt in the sense that, you know, this is important. The economy is based on it. You just said the state's losing $15 million a day right now with the port closed. By the way, the port isn't out of operation. The port is closed because I can't get in and they can't get out.
Correct.
But the port is still there. All the facilities are still there. The bridge is out. So, you know, there's a lot of terminals that are going to have access issues. But the port is not, the port is waiting for them to clear the debris, or at least open the channel. And it would seem to me that that's, you know, one of the priorities once they've recovered the bodies that are down there and the vehicles that are there and tried to do the best they can to assure themselves there are no more. Then it's to clear the channel and reopen the port. First things first, it would seem. But, you know, it's going to take a while. Baltimore is the number one at the moment, and there's always change. They change all the time because of competition between the ports. Your membership are constantly trying to, you know, steal business away from each other. And Baltimore at the moment is the number one import operation of vehicles on the East Coast.
Yep.
That's a big, big deal. There's nothing, not inconsequential, and that port is closed, right? Nobody can unload, nobody can get in to unload, nobody can get out once they've unloaded. And one of the seven ships that's in right now is a vehicle carrier. Other people are going to take that business. It's probably going to take a long time before Baltimore gets back to 50, you know, to be the number one vehicle port on the East Coast. I mean, this will probably be a long-lasting effect. Do you see other long-lasting effects right now, or just things to watch for everybody?
Sure. First thing I want to say, you're absolutely right about people in Baltimore being more identified with the port. I visited a lot of ports in my time with AAPA, and yeah, it's much more central to their culture than it is in other states and cities. You're certainly right about that. And I think, you know, it also has lawmakers' attention because of its proximity to DC. I mean, a lot of people in this region have driven over that 695 bridge. They're very familiar with it. So I think you're right on the money there. The question of how long until vehicles are back, until they're the number one, you know, I think for a long time, people thought there's no way anyone will do more containers ever than Los Angeles and Long Beach. Then that shifted, you know, pretty rapidly to New York, New Jersey became number one. And people thought, all right, people are sick of the West Coast. It's going to be New York, New Jersey for a long time. We're now seeing that's not the case anymore. I think LA just announced they're up 70% over the last few months. So I don't necessarily think it will take that long. I think we learned in the last few years that it's much easier than we thought to move cargo from one port to another. So I do think there's you know, I don't think it'll take that long for Baltimore to be back on top, but who knows? And I think one of the reasons an organization like AAPA exists, or any trade association, is as kind of a convening place, a meeting place for its members. So I can tell you in the past week, we've had people reach out, hey, my client moves farm equipment. They move it through the port of Baltimore. Can you tell us where else they might be able to move it? And so we have a unique position of having kind of a view over the whole industry, and allows us to help, not that we're solving the problem, but certainly help out as people are scrambling to figure out how to keep their cargo flowing.
The whole idea of awareness, people are certainly aware of what's going on. I mean, it's got everybody's attention, and the economic impact, nobody knows yet. And again, business moves with flow, supply and demand. Yep. And if the supply is cut off here, but the demand is still there, business tends to find a way to make that happen someplace else. All right. Well, folks, our guest has been Derek Miller. He's the Government Relations Director for American Association of Port Authorities. Derek, thanks so much for being on and talking about this. This is a very important sea power issue. The operation of ports, the whole point of sea power is to guarantee commerce. And this is a major issue. So thanks for being here, Derek.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. We are joined again by our friend Xavier Vavasseur, the founder and editor-in-chief of Naval News, based in Paris, France. Welcome back to the podcast, Xavier.
Hi, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here, to be back.
So, Xavier, you're talking to us now from outside Paris. You know, more than many people I know, you regularly travel the world to report on naval developments from a variety of countries. Earlier this year, you were at a big defense exposition in Saudi Arabia, the World Defense Show, in February. And most recently, you were at DIMDEX, the Doha International Maritime Defense Expedition in Qatar in early March. Those expositions really give defense suppliers worldwide a chance to showcase their wares. Everybody wants to sell to the Middle East because they have money and they buy things. But it's also for nations and delegations from nations to also show up and do the same thing, market their country. What are some of the trends you were seeing this earlier this year?
What really stood out for me at the World Defense Show in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, and I was very surprised, was the fact that many shipbuilders were showcasing and pitching submarines for apparently Royal Saudi Navy requirement. The two Korean shipbuilders, Hyundai Heavy Industries and Hanwha Ocean, were showcasing some designs. The Italians were showcasing their designs as well. The Spanish as well, Navantia. The French, I tried to... The French, surprisingly, were the only ones who were not showcasing anything. They didn't really want to talk about submarines, but maybe that was, a signal in a way, a message in a way that there's definitely a topic regarding submarines for Saudi Arabia. So talking to Hyundai Heavy Industries, they were pitching a larger submarine design based on... it's a larger version of a submarine that they designed for the Korean Special Forces. The Korean submarine is 500 tons, but the one they are proposing to Saudi Arabia is about 800 tons. So it's an upscale version of that. Hanwha Ocean, to my surprise, they were showcasing their big submarines, the KSS-3, which displaces 3,000 tons. Fincantieri of Italy, they were showcasing two designs, what they call the Type 212 NFS, which is the future submarine class of the Italian Navy, based on the German TKMS Type 212 submarine. They were also showcasing a smaller submarine design, which was unveiled in the United Arab Emirates last year. And when I talked to Navantia of Spain, they confirmed that they were talking to Saudi Arabia regarding their S-80 submarine. And all these designs are very different. Some are very small, some are quite large. So, I mean, to me, that's an indication that maybe the requirements are not set in stone yet. Maybe Saudi Arabia is still looking at their options and requirements. Talking to my dear friend and naval reporter, Richard Scott, who usually writes for Jane's, he told me that that's actually not really new, because about 10 years ago, Saudi Arabia sent a number of sailors to one of their partner navies, maybe Malaysia or Pakistan, he could not remember exactly, but they sent a number of Saudi sailors for some kind of training and internship on board a submarine. So it's interesting that, yeah, they're definitely looking at submarine. And I got from a source recently, but I could not confirm this yet. Delegation from the Royal Saudi Navy visited a European submarine shipbuilder facility earlier this month.
So all this, I mean, all this industrial activity, people think the Saudis are serious about us, about buying some sort of submarine.
Yeah, oh yeah, the definitely. I mean, the fact that from a naval perspective, because the World Defense Show is a tri-service exposition. There's a lot of vehicles. There's even there's a lot of aircraft as well. I mean, as crazy as it sounds, like the venue is in the middle of nowhere, like literally in a desert. It's about 40 minutes drive north of Riyadh, and they built an airport there. And it's not a commercial airport. They built the airport and the landing strip exclusively for the exhibition that's held once every 2 years. So yeah, the naval side of the exhibition is not the main focus, definitely not. But from a naval perspective, because that was my focus, submarines this year was really front and center. Like it was very, I mean, you could not miss it.
I mean, it really sounds incredible. I've not been. This is a new show. And I've not been to it. I mean, there is sort of a, you know, feeling as you go around the Middle East, and it's some countries much more than other. But you know, you go visit, and it's the building is so extravagant, so over the top.
There's other odd aspects to that event as well. It was the case 2 years ago. It was the case again this year. The fact that they are live, they are not part of the. Of the floor, there are live Patriot batteries protecting the venue because of the threat posed by the Houthis, of course. But that's quite interesting as well, and they are hard to miss. I mean, as you drive to the venue, you cannot miss them. You see the Patriot batteries right there around the venue.
So no ships, obviously, in the middle of the desert.
Unfortunately, not. No.
But dim decks in Doha, Doha is a significant port on the Persian Gulf in Qatar. And one of the attractive aspects of that show is usually a number of ships come in, European ships, and for the most part, some Americans and Brits, and Russians, Chinese, ships from all around the region. And it's always a good venue to see some shipping that you might not otherwise get to see up close and personal. But also a lot of commanders come. They have a large naval conference in association with Dimdex. So you were there earlier in March.
Right.
You know, the flavor of these shows kind of moves up around depending on the political flavor of the moment. People buying a lot. Sometimes they're downsizing. I'm just curious. Did you see anything from the war, from the Houthi campaign, anything at all?
Actually, it's more about what I guess what I didn't see.
Right.
Like you, we both attended the DIMDEX back in 2014, 2016, and so on. And back then, you're right, as you mentioned, there used to be a lot of visiting ships. This year, there really was not a whole lot. I believe there were only six of them. There was no American ships, no British ships, no French ship. So yeah, it was definitely on a smaller scale, and I'm pretty convinced it all has to do with the situation in the Red Sea. Of course, the ships that won't typically visit such events, they are now busy protecting commercial shipping in the Red Sea, and as a consequence, well, no visiting ships at the venue. But let's be honest here, that's not there. Of course, that's not why they were built and why the crew were trained. So they're just doing their job, basically.
Xavier, building on Chris's question, I'm interested in the unmanned side, whether it be for at sea or surface, subsurface, or air. What did you pick up at either show in the way of unmanned offerings? Anything grab your attention?
There's unmanned, and then there's a counter unmanned as well. Not necessarily for the naval side, but the show in Saudi Arabia, there was a lot, and I mean a lot of counter UAVs, counter UAS systems. That really was another of the focus at the event. In Qatar, there was a lot of unmanned systems, but mostly from Turkey, because there's been a very strong Turkish presence at this event, but also more generally speaking, there's a very strong cooperation going on between Qatar and Turkey. So the biggest presence in terms of exhibitors were definitely the ones from Turkey. In terms of USVs, so there used to be five what I call tactical size USVs from Turkey, five different designs from five different contractors. Well, a sixth design, so an additional one, was unveiled at DIMDEX from a Turkish company. And again, it's I call it tactical because it's fairly small. It's about 12 meters in size, but it's very interesting to observe, to see how Turkey is pushing in the, on the USV side, after being so popular, of course, with UAVs.
Right.
The company Icar, who's the builder of the now famous TB2, who's had a relative success in Ukraine early on in the war.
Bayraktar.
Yeah.
Let's go back to counter UAS just for a quick second. What type of counter UAS? I mean, I imagine there was a variety, but did anything stand out? Dazzler, laser, kinetic. I mean, or did you kind of see the? Did you see it all? And the only reason I ask is, I mean, these are really the same types of lessons that folks here in the United States are learning and trying to take away from both Ukraine and in the Red Sea.
Right. I think what's at least on the international scene, there seems to be now a push on electronic warfare type counter UAS. I believe just because it's probably more affordable. You don't have to expend expensive ammunition or even kinetic ammunition. With electronic warfare, you procure it once, you buy it once, and then it You don't have to pay for ammo, basically. I think in I mean, actually both in Saudi and Qatar, that's what kind of dominated the show floor. And such systems are coming to the naval domain as well, because I know in France there's a number of programs to fit such solutions on Navy ships, and they kind of started, of course, a few years ago, but it seems that things are getting fast tracked now because of the Red Sea. And that's something I learned during the show in Qatar, actually. The French Navy issued an urgent operational requirement to upgrade the EOIR system on all its what they call first rank frigates, so the French frigates and the air warfare destroyers, just to be able to better identify threats at the distances, and so that the crew inside the CIC can decide whether they should counter the UAVs with expensive missiles, or if they can just use naval gunfire to down the threat.
Yeah, I'm expecting that we'll see and hear a fair amount of that when we go to the Navy League show here. I guess it's 2 weeks away. That there's a lot of talk about it. I don't know that it's quite made it as far as what you're seeing overseas, but it'll be interesting to see as we prep for that conference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. In Qatar again, a Turkish company was showcasing for the first time EW-based counter UAS system, consisting in four antennas, four jammers that you would fit on any vessels to counter UAVs.
When you were in Qatar, especially, you also talked to some naval leadership. I know that you talked to Admiral Wyckoff, who's the new commander of U.S. Naval Forces in Central Command. He was there. But you also spoke with French Admiral Slars, Emmanuel right. Slars, yeah. Who's the commander of French Joint Forces in the Indian Ocean.
To Wyckoff, basically.
And I'm just curious, it's you get when you interview people like this, sometimes you get you get to compare tone and emphasis. And do you think everybody's on the same page? Those two, I know you did. I'm not sure if you did some more, please speak up. Did everybody sound pretty much on the same page, same open, same goals? I mean, I think they're all trying to, protect merchant shipping from Houthi attack, but in terms of tactics,
yeah, I mean, both the American and the French admirals they insisted on the importance of training, and they kind of said it's because of the training and the proficiency and professionalism of the crews that they can successfully counter threats in the Red Sea, and so far they were able to do a good job. I asked them about technical details, or more like their opinion whether ships as they are fitted currently, did they feel like they were able to counter the wide arrays of threats that is thrown at them by the Houthis, because let's be honest, there's been talks of everything, UUVs, USVs, one-way attack UAVs, and even anti-ship ballistic missiles. But I guess unsurprisingly, both reluctant to get into details about this specific aspect regarding the system, the equipment fitted on the ships. But otherwise, I guess everybody is more or less on the same page. Then of course, the US and UK kind of went on the offensive, trying to strike some Houthi targets ashore. And for some political reasons, the French decided not to join.
But so, on a defensive note, I don't want to leave this. So, subsequent to your visit to Qatar, actually, I think it was March 21st, a French warship, which we all think was the Alsace, FREM air defense frigate, engaged and destroyed three Houthi ballistic missiles over the Red Sea, probably using Aster 30 missiles, which is the larger version of the Aster family of surface-to-air missiles. That would be the first combat kills for the Aster family of missiles, and pretty significant development.
First combat kill against a ballistic missile, yes.
Yeah, I mean, can you speak to that? I mean, what does that mean for the French Navy? How significant would that be? It sounds like it's a real thing. This isn't a minor accomplishment.
It really, really is a big thing. It is a big deal. The issue is for now, the French are not sharing many details regarding this engagement. I mean, sure, they released the video and so on, but they won't provide any clear information regarding which missile exactly were intercepted, how many missiles were fired from the frigate to counter those missiles. But I'm sure with time we will get more and more details. But I mean, sure, yes, it came as a surprise, and actually we were not even sure that in its baseline configuration, because that's what the French have right now, the Block Zero, the Aster 30, we were not sure the Aster 30 could intercept ballistic missiles. So that's actually quite an achievement, because that's not the main focus. Like, I mean, those air defense frigates, they were not really designed to counter such threats. So again, it's quite an achievement. But to go back to the training issue, it's the former Chief of Navy, Admiral Vandier, who decided to really increase and focus on the training of the French Navy overall, and decided, like, once every 2 years, they would conduct a fleet-wide, very intensive and complex training, so that the French sailors would be more proficient in full-fledged combat.
Xavier, I've got one last one for you, and then you've been very generous with your time, so I don't want to hold you too long. But, you know, Chris asked about the continuity among some of the partner nation leadership. I was wondering what you heard about Houthi capability and the length of this conflict. I mean, we're starting to hear more and more, I guess, surprise that this has gone on as long as it has. Did you hear similar sentiment over there? Did you pick up anything else about the Houthi threat and, you know, what some of the either industry or partner navies, you know, were thinking about duration or lessons learned?
Not really. Again, the Navy leadership I talked to was being very, very cautious about about their engagement with me. No, about the duration of the conflict, no, they didn't say anything. But overall, they were quite happy with the European Union setting up Operation Aspides. Everybody agreed that this was going in the right direction. Because I guess arguably Europe, from a Red Sea perspective and maritime traffic, is the continent that is the most affected by the situation. So that went into the right direction for sure. But Europe as a whole got together to try and act. But other than that, no, not really. One last thing I'd like to share about Steam Deck. I got the chance to interview the chief of Portuguese Navy on their future fleet structure and on a new upcoming class. And it all has to do again about unmanned. So basically, when I interviewed Admiral Melo, he explained that a new ship design, which is kind of like a small scale LHD, like a small LHD. I mean, it's going to be a family of LHDs, displacing between 7,000 and 9,000 tons. So that's fairly small. So those ships are going to act as, and we discussed this last time we talked on the podcast. They're going to act as motherships. So they'll be able to carry about 50 drones each. So drones for like surface and air operations. They'll have a very small crew of about 50 sailors. And that was the most surprising part for me. They plan on, that's in their planning for their fleet structure. They will replace their frigates with those vessels. Because they believe first it's more affordable, and second they can achieve more effects with the combinations of those UUVs, USVs, and UAVs compared to the kind of effect you can achieve with a regular frigate. So in the near future, the Portuguese Navy is going to consist of only three types of vessels, submarines, a new class of 500 tons patrol vessel, which will also be able to carry unmanned systems and those drone motherships. And I kept seeing this is a breakthrough and this is highly unusual, and kept telling me that's the future, and he's convinced that's the way forward.
Well, Xavier, thank you very much for joining us this week. We'll have to leave it there. We've been talking to Xavier Vavasor, the founder and editor-in-chief of Naval News. I really appreciate you joining us. Chris and I talk often about, he mentioned at the top, your ability to get out and about. One, it makes us jealous, but two, it really does help not only Chris and I, but the entire listenership stay up to date as to what's going on, especially with our European and Middle Eastern partner navies and industry folks. So thank you again for joining us. Look forward to seeing you at the Navy League show here in a few weeks. And I'll put a plug in for the Naval News website. I've become a big fan. I've known you for over a decade, but have really within the last 2 or 3 years become an avid reader and avid consumer of the products that you guys produce. So thank you very much for what you guys are doing.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Both of you, Chris and Chris, it's always a pleasure. And yeah, indeed, I look forward to see you guys pretty soon at Sierra Space. And for the people who are going to check out our website next week, don't forget that on April 1st we typically publish some kind of unusual story, so be on the lookout for that story. And I'm sure Chris knows what I'm talking about.
Exactly, a little April Fool's tease.
Exactly,
there. That's great. I'm glad you reminded us of that. That's fantastic. Thank you again, Xavier.
Thank you again.
Well, that does it for this week. As always, our thanks go out to Vago Moradian and the Defense and Aerospace Group for their support. The Cavas Ships podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is a trusted defense and technologies partner supporting all services in all domains and America's only builder of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. HII, delivering the advantage.
Be sure to follow us at Cavas Ships on Twitter. And remember, This podcast is available on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Cervello.
And I'm Chris Cavas. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.